Shofar sounds a proclamation of a new year. In ancient Israel, whenever a new moon was sighted, the shofar was sounded in the shrine to signal the turning of the month, the passage of time. Today, the shofar sounds not only to signal the passage of time, but to announce this service, Rosh Hashanah, an affirmation of time and of the promise of time. So far, sounds a challenge to make the most of the new year. For life is not looked upon by our tradition as an endurance contest, but as an opportunity. We ask God for a Shana Tova Ubatuka, good year, sweet, satisfying year. And the service makes us recognize that what we do, how we live, the standard of our conduct will determine in largest measure the quality of the new year for us. Now, long before modern medicine had removed the shadow of death from childbearing and childhood, long before modern science and technology had removed from the backs of the human beast the heavy burdens that he was forced to bear, at a time when most religions and philosophies looked upon life as a wearisome burden, as a via misericordia, a brutal, brief, burdensome passage between the cradle and the grave, the via dolorosa, a way that was full of anxiety and anguish and tears. The time when most societies accepted life because they had no alternative, looked for the peace that lies beyond the grave. Our tradition affirmed life, pleaded with God for life, for opportunity, saw the possibility implicit in the new year. Our tradition asked us to cultivate a certain faith. Faith that looked beyond the difficulties, the dangers, the traumatic moments of the moment, the long uphill struggle, achievement of civilization. Weeping may tarry for the night. The joy cometh with the morning. Our tradition asked us to find at the end of the workday the calm of the heart, the peace of the family, the quiet of the moments of intimacy, the joys that do come true, and the hopes that in fact are realized. And it sought to place before us a duty that was not simply dour and burdensome, the simcha shel mitzvah, the joy of joining with God as a partner in the work of creation, the joy of doing what we ought to do, not simply because it is right, but because something was satisfying to our soul. The knowledge that we were part of the long pilgrimage of man from primitive condition, the establishment on earth, the kingdom of God. We were to serve God with joy. Do it Adonai b'simcha, O lefanav b'ranana, the psalmist sang. Serve the Lord with joy. Come before the Lord song. The shofar sounds. The shofar sounds the sound of promise. Where the ancient Greeks said that which has been is that which shall be, you can expect in the new year very much what you found in the old year. Shofar says to us that which has been is that which need not be. The new year can be filled with the unfolding of your soul, development of new talents, the engagement of yourself with new friends, the undertaking of new responsibilities, all manner of things which can bring satisfaction, quiet happiness, joy to your being. Do et Adonai b'simcha, bo lefanav b'ranana. Serve the Lord with joy. Come before the Lord with song. Generations are not doomed to experience again and duplicate all of the suffering of the generations that went before. Each year, each day, each of us can find something which unfolds his soul, enlarges his spirit, satisfies his being. There are joys that do come true. Shofar sounds to tell us if we have the eyes but to see, we can rejoice in the varied beauties of nature. It's not a matter of chance that the psalmists were the first of all the poets of mankind to sing of the glories of God's handiwork. The shofar sounds to tell us that if we have ears but to hear, there are a thousand melodies which can reach our soul and move us to sense the harmonies of the universe. And if our mind thrusts and thirsts for knowledge, there's the fascination of the new, the fascination of understanding. And if our hearts are open to love, there are all the depths and the wonders of feeling and of intimacy, of sharing, of togetherness. Do et Adonai b'simcha, bo lefanav b'ranana. And we are so inured to the promise of time. We who are the children of the age of reason and the industrial revolution, of all the miracles of modern technology, that we assume that the faith which is implicit in Rosh Hashanah, written large into our liturgy, faith which comes to us on the chants and the songs of tonight, that this faith is inevitable, instinctive. It's the given. It's hard, in fact it takes an historian to remind us that when our fathers proclaimed their faith in the promise of time, when they affirmed the possibilities of life, they did so going beyond all the evidence of their experience. Peoples of other faiths and of other cultures had shared the experience of life in ancient times, and they came to the contrary conclusion. They sought only somehow to escape from the burdens of life, or to withdraw sufficiently into themselves that whatever happened to them, they could not be hurt. They looked for joy not in this world, but in some other life. What allowed our fathers to go beyond their experience, to proclaim, to affirm the promise of time? Their affirmation was a reflex of their faith in God. Faith of the God who created life and opportunity. Genesis 1, the great chapter which is the very beginning of Scripture, that's a chapter which affirms creation, was not put there as a science text, as some foolish literalists would have us believe today as they try to impose what they call creationism on the physics texts of our high school. It was placed there as a great statement of faith. Faith in the possibilities of life. After each day of creation, God steps back from his handiwork, and he looks about, Vayar Ki Tov, and he sees that what he has done is good. The universe is sufficient to sustain life. This good earth is sufficient for man to build upon it, decent societies. We have within us talent sufficient, spirit sufficient, quality sufficient to build the good society. The city of God here on earth, if we have but the will and the wisdom and the wit, can be done. Creation is sufficient. The needs that we have of it. Faith led our fathers to affirm the possibilities of life. It was not an easy faith. They suffered all of the cruelties of early man. Their lifespan was short. They suffered under the burdens of heavy labor. For the most part, they lived a small minority on the narrow edge of tolerance. Interestingly, in our Talmud, we read that when you and I come before the heavenly gates and ask for admission, the archangel Michael will have only one question to put before us. Hatzipita Lishua. Did you have the courage to hold fast to the promise of time? Israel's hope of redemption. It's interesting that our sages should say that of all the questions that could be asked of us at that time, this would be the one question we would be forced to answer. One would have expected that we'd be asked about our achievements, asked about our character, asked about the quality of our person, of our relationships, our contributions to society. But no. Hatzipita l'Yeshua. Did you continue to hold fast to the promise of time? Now, why this question? Because those who despair, those who abandon hope, inevitably turn in on themselves, withdraw from their relationship, withdraw from the responsibilities of the day. Why involve yourself if, in fact, nothing can be accomplished? Inevitably, they are less than they might have been because we enlarge ourselves, develop our talents, develop our spirit, our capacities, in measure as we involve ourselves in the concerns of our community, of our family, of humanity. Tzipita l'Yeshua. Will we be able to say on that day when ultimately our life is summed up, we held fast to our hope? Somehow, despite all the buffeting of those difficult centuries, most in Israel were able to say, we held fast, we were steadfast. Certainly our faith throughout the long centuries was always a messianic faith, a faith which affirmed that weeping may tarry for the night, for the morning there is joy. There are hopes that do come true and joys that can be realized, that there is reason to look, to anticipate tomorrow, the new year. When I speak of faith, faith in the promise of time, because we have come through a long period where even those of little faith were convinced the future would be bright indeed. I can remember not so long ago when I was still in college attending a graduation, not my own, in which the speaker waxed eloquent about the miracles that were pouring out of our laboratories and our research institutions. I remember his saying to the group that more new discovery had occurred in their lifetime, their brief 20 years or 21 years upon Earth, than all of previously recorded history. I remember his waxing eloquent about the unlimited horizons which lay open before them, the opportunities that were there. And I remember thinking as I listened to that speech, even then, that there was something slightly anachronistic about his optimism. We had just come through the Second World War, and all of us had seen the miracles of modern technology used for more efficient destruction. The death camps had opened. We had seen what Hitler's professionals, his professors, his technicians could manage through their skills. Even then, it was clear that the atomic bomb had been dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki years before atomic energy could be used for peaceful use. Modern man, for the last several hundred years, has been confident, full of anticipation. No one had to preach to him about the promise of time. And then in the last few decades or so, there's been a dramatic change, has there not, in our mood. I don't know of any other period in recorded history in which the human spirit has so quickly turned around. For suddenly, where once we looked forward so eagerly to the future, now we know deep down that the future is not what it once, just a few years ago, had been. Instead of anticipation, we are anxious. We are concerned. We've all had a metaphor for this change, a symbol of it. As we've watched these past months, President Reagan has proposed a new budget to the nation. A budget which, for whatever other reasons it has produced for us, says very clearly, the great society has become a lesser society, that there are things that we cannot do. There are services, necessary services, which we cannot tender. We cannot provide the level of social welfare, the level of civic immunity that just a few months ago we assumed as essential, basic. certainly within the pocket and the ability of the most powerful and richest nation on earth. Though there are some who would comfort themselves by saying that this diminishment of our society is simply a matter of incorrect emphases and programs by this administration, that if we were not putting so much in armament, there would be enough to be put into the social welfare and humane part of the budget, I submit to you that the very need for armaments is part of the truth, the sad truth of our times. For not only do we live in an economy of limits, not only have we, as population, pushed the limits of the ability of the earth to provide decency for those who are already upon it, but we live in an earth of people who are full of passion and anger and greed and ambition. Every year for the last 30 years, the peoples of this earth have spent a greater proportion of their wealth upon armaments and a lesser proportion of their wealth upon education and social services than they did the year before. The tragedy of the AWACS is not simply that Israel's security may be in danger, but that the Saudis will spend $8.5 billion irreplaceable oil dollars for sophisticated weapons which cannot possibly be used against the lightly armed guerrillas who will surely someday overthrow that feudal monarchy. We live in a time of diminished hope. Quite suddenly, quite swiftly, the assumptions of the past 2 centuries have been stripped away from us. If we are to hold on to the promise of time, we have to hold on to it as did our fathers, not because they could prove it from the experience of their day, but because they affirmed it on the basis of their faith in their God. For a long time now, sociologists, write essayists, and preachers have been concerned about the revolution of rising expectations. The eye is never satisfied with seeing. We always want more than we seem to have. How would the world possibly provide all of the luxuries, all of the indulgences, all of the dainties, the fancies that man seemed to have? I confess that this time I'm far more concerned about the revolution of diminished expectations. Because when man is frustrated, when man feels that something is being taken away from him, that somehow, for some reason, he only barely understands there is less and not more, that the future is dismal rather than bright, he becomes angry and bitter, he lashes out against. He is willing to listen to those who promise simplistic answers to the complex and almost irresolvable problems of the day. It's out of such an environment that Hitler emerged. It's in such an environment that anger is beginning to be heard again in our land, as has been heard for a while throughout the world. The anger of minority against minority, of race against race, of class against class, of the ins against the outs, of the other America against the larger America. We're moving into difficult times. And the dangers are not simply the dangers we all perceive, the dangers of an arms race, the dangers of technological malfunction in our sophisticated weaponry, the dangers of overpopulation, the dangers of dependency upon oil and other such resources, the dangers ourselves. We have yet to prove that we have the ability not to be blinded by anger and frustration, to hold on to reason, to remain steadfast in our convictions, to continue to struggle to do what must be done. You know, there's goodness, and there's a semblance of goodness. It was easy to be good, to open up the opportunity of society, to provide for the other America when nothing was being taken from us. But it's another thing to keep the society open, to provide for the other America when it demands something of us. Higher taxes, a greater greater expenditure of energy, a lowered standard of our living. And that's the truth of it. 50 years ago, I assure you that those who sat in this room on Rosh Hashanah assumed that we, their children, would live better than they had ever lived. And we did. And we have. But will their grandchildren live as well, and their great-grandchildren? If we talk simply materialistically, I seriously doubt it. We live in a world of an economy of limits. We have obviously been careless of the natural resource. We have been careless of population. We have been careless of all that sustains decency. And now the piper must be paid. And now inflation must be faced. Higher taxation must be faced. And the angers of those who are denied must be faced. And the expectations which cannot be met must be faced. And we must face all of these problems steadily, courageously, at a time when our own lives are less secure, less certain than they once were. So the challenge is the age-old challenge, Hatzipita l'Yeshua. Have you the courage, through it all, whatever be the difficulties of the day, to hold on to the promise of time? What can I do? Problems are overwhelming. I'm one among 3 billion earthlings. What can I do? The answer? What has anyone ever done? Yet there is a great deal that is good and civilized in our world. Civilization is not the actions of those who make the headlines. They can only do what their society allows them to do. If the society is at work, peaceful, secure, rational, and reasonable, leaders can be rational and reasonable. If society is angry, embittered, flailing out, they will find leaders who will flay out and be angry and embittered. Civilization consists of the love, tender, loving care of our children. Consists of the love, the tender, loving education the teacher offers in the classroom. It consists of the hope, the time, the shoulder we offer to a friend. It consists of all the 1,000 acts of kindness, of encouragement, love, empathy, sympathy, which we offer each other each day. And if you say, demands are so overwhelming, how can I possibly give of myself in a sense proportionate to the need? I remind you that our fathers in their wisdom put into the very heart of this day, which affirms the promise of time, as the Torah reading the story of the sacrifice demanded of Abraham. A sacrifice demanded of far more than any of us ought ever to be asked. And Abraham, according to the legend, was willing to make that sacrifice. There are no guarantees that our commitment to the causes we hold dear, to that which is right, our concerns with our families, our concerns with our community, will succeed. And if they do, they may demand a great deal of us. Moses never reached the promised land. The challenge is there. The need is there. We recognize the rightness of what is needed. We recognize that we were not called in this life simply to be secure, to be at ease in Zion. I've often wondered why Amos thundered out against by saying, "Woe unto those who are at ease in Zion." What's wrong with being at ease in Zion or anywhere else? What's wrong is that when we are at ease, we are indifferent. We are unconcerned, and being indifferent and unconcerned, we are less. We are not growing, we're diminishing. We're not using our talents. They're atrophying, they're rusting. As we involve ourselves, the responsibilities of our time, whatever the demands, we find the joy of service, we find developing within us capacities, talents, and abilities we hardly knew were there, which were dormant until that moment. So the question, Sipita Lishua, will you and I, over the long challenging years which lie before us, have the courage to affirm the possibility, the promise of time? It should be easier for us than for our ancestors. They had no evidence that the age-old burdens of poverty, burdensome labor could be removed. We have. We know what men can do. Simply that we now must pay the price for centuries of carelessness. There's every reason for you and I to know that our problems can be solved because, after all, the problems which disturb us are manufactured, man-made. There's no natural law that says that Arab states may not recognize Israel and make peace with Israel. That's simply a decision of Arab governments. And there's no natural law which says that we must be involved in an arms race across the globe. Again, that's a decision of governments, people. And there's no natural law, it's not written in the heavens, that the KGB and the CIA and all of the other arms of every other government in the world must be undermining governments they don't like and supporting governments they do and creating confusion and chaos around the world. Those two are decisions of individuals and of governments, manufactured, man-made, therefore resolvable. I'm not going to stand here and say to you that I've never believed that problems ultimately have solutions. Life is a process. Certainly it's true that war is not inevitable, poverty is not inevitable, none of the dire predictions of that I hear from time to time are inevitable. The new year can be a good year. We and all like us have the capacity to make it so. We only have faith in our God. We only remember that though the headlines be dark from time to time, God gave us sufficient capacity to handle the problems that face us. Sipita Lishua, will you have the faith to allow you to be steadfast, to continue to do what needs to be done, to be open to your family, to be open to human need, to be open to the possibilities of the day and of tomorrow and of the next day? Can you avoid that frustration and that anger which will turn you into an irrational being, make you easy prey for the demagogue, the leader, who will promise you panacea, solution, glory, but all anyone can promise you is the joy of doing what needs to be done without any guarantee you'll ever be able to see that work to completion, but with a guarantee God has a purpose for our life and for all life, that you will be contributing in that way the unfolding of your own personality to the unfolding of the possibilities of human society. I close with a favorite saying of mine, which I found originally in the works of an early 19th century Hasidic Rebbe. His name was Mendel of Kotsk. He said this: there are three ways open to a person who is in sorrow. He who stands the normal way weeps. He who stands in a higher rung is silent. He who stands in the highest rung of all turns his sorrow into a song. It's only natural to weep. Those of us who have had reason to cry know that ultimately we must dry our tears and turn away from self-pity and turn back into the world, but the world hasn't come yet to an end. And there is courage in those who can face life without complaint, silently, stoically. But the silence itself is a pulling away, a withdrawing from. It's a stealing of oneself against. The rare person, you and I, we have the courage, we have the vision, can turn dismay, anxiety to a song. Our song. Sidney used to say that there's a song in each soul. If you'll only allow the song to come forth, your life will have its natural shape, follow its natural destiny. And most of us have welled up, have shielded our souls against the expression of that song, wanting to get, wanting to enjoy, wanting to control, wanting to manipulate. Sometimes when the broken heart occurs, the song can escape, can be heard. We come to follow the natural shape which our life should have. So if we listen to the faith of our people, faith in God and faith in the promise of time, and take that faith to heart, have no fear of the future. The new year is full of challenge. The measure of our challenge is a measure of opportunity. Have no fear. Be confident. God has a purpose for life. God has a purpose for your life. And you can fulfill that purpose fully, wisely, well. Amen.